Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, welcome to another Hullastepa. This week with Pakalakadakdak himself, Pocahontas, Jeremy Paxman. Now, this one was recorded 1 week after I had had an orchidectomy. That's right. My ball had been removed, and yet I still came out of my sickbed to record this for you. Am I a hero? I don't like to use the word hero. I like you to use the word hero, because I'm a hero for doing this for you. You know, given the temperament of the guest and the host, you would think that maybe it was the guest who'd had a testicle removed, but that's just me. So I hope you're enjoying these, and they should continue as long as I can. I'm feeling very well, and got a bit more treatment to come, but I think I'm basically all right, kids. And I will be back doing all the Twitch channel stuff as soon as I can. Twitch of Fun will return pretty soon, maybe this week, maybe next. We'll see how I'm feeling. And Snooker should be back soon, and even stone clearing. Who knows? Maybe I will clear some stones at some point. Head to gofasterstripe.com/badges to become a monthly badger. You get lots of extras. You help us make more content. You can buy books and downloads there as GoFasterStripe as well, if you wish. Just keep on enjoying the podcast. If you can listen to them with the adverts, that is very helpful. If you can just spread the word to your friends about this amazing interview with Grumpy Pakalakalakdakdakdakdick. I love him. Jeremy Paxman. Sit back and relax, man, with Jeremy Paxman on Ruh-huh-luh-stuh-puh. Sorry about the wavy background. There was nothing I could do. I'm living in a world of static. Please welcome a man, he's back from the dead, it's Richard Herring. Hello, welcome to another episode of Richard Herring's Left Side Testicle Podcast. I was hanging out with the incredible staff at the Lister Hospital in Stevenage. I never knew I'd be so grateful to people who would semi-castrate me, but I really am. They call it Rahulastaba. So, As you may have gathered from last week's show, I told a total stranger about my testicles as the first thing I said to her. I did have a ball removed last Wednesday. It's a week. I've been a week of being a mono ball, a uniball. I'm trying to get sponsorship from Uniball. Don't know if they'll go with that. I've had a week in bed. I've had no children, no childcare, no schooling. Been watching TV, playing video games, having all my food brought to me for a week. It's the best holiday I've had in 6 years. It's absolutely worth a testicle. That week, I'm telling you, I'm considering just taking the other one off so I can make this a fortnight. We will see. There'll be more about this as we go on. I'm not going to talk about it too much tonight, that's a nice graphic of that. I got some jock straps delivered this week because I need support for my testicles. And they arrived, there were three of them. They were the wrong size, but it was all right. They made them extra, extra large, and I needed that. Even with a third of my genitalia gone, I still needed that. But they gave me some free gifts, which included a pair of ankle socks and some Despicable Me stickers that I hadn't asked for. Were just in the box. I don't know whether that's just a service the jockstrap people do. That's my bum there, by the way, in the picture. That is me. It's a picture of I look. So that's a good merchy question coming up. What's the weirdest thing that you've been sent by accident or that you didn't ask for? My favorite thing my daughter's done this week is that's some balls. More balls, balls. That's balls. Let's see if I've got it. Oh, no, I haven't got the picture. I'll do this one. Amazon have got into trouble because their new logo apparently looks too much like a Hitler moustache. Because Hitler famously had a blue moustache, which was all kind of... You can see from the picture next to Hitler there, it's exactly the same as the blue and with all bumpy stuff at the bottom. So they've changed that. I mean, I think because people complained that it reminded them Hitler, and it's now a sort of a sticker coming off a box. But that reminds me of Dr. Harold Shipman putting a plaster on someone and taking off and then smiling while he's doing it. So Amazon are going to have to change. It's nothing like Hitler, terrible people. My daughter has started calling the Incredible Hulk, but she calls it the Credible Hulk, which I quite like. And I think that I'd prefer to watch that. Just a believable Hulk. It's sort of Lou Ferrigno, not green. If he can't jump off the top of a roof because he'll break his legs. I think it's a good idea. So we'll see how that goes on. We're about to find out whether my interviewing power came from my right testicle. Hopefully it didn't. I don't want to laugh too much today because that if I sneeze or laugh, it still hurts down here. They go in through the abdomen, by the way. So it's not as bad as you might think. Let's introduce my guest this week. My wife also lost a tooth this week. It's been quiet. And my daughter lost a tooth, but that's not so bad. But I'm sure my wife was trying to steal focus from me. So she was my nurse, but then she was in too much pain and had to go and have her tooth pulled out. We're having a terrible time. We're getting old, getting very old. At least I hope we will. Anyway, my guest this week is probably best known for being the fishing editor of Esquire magazine and appearing as himself in The Gay Daleks. That is why we're here. It's Pakalakadakdak himself. It's Jeremy Paxman, ladies and gentlemen. There he is. He's not quite in frame.
Which way am I? That way, that one.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very, very well, thank you very much. I've just worked out where the camera is, roughly.
Good. As long as you stay there, you look like a giant. Hey, we've had a lot of fun setting this one up. I'm predicting things will go wrong, but in the technical
I should have
terms,
thought so. Yeah, what I wanted to know is, is there a ball fairy that comes along if you lose your ball and you get a shilling or something?
I asked the exact same question last week, and I didn't get to keep it because they have to take it away and find out what's wrong with it. I was very keen. I'm on Taskmaster, which is a Channel 4 show I don't know if you're aware of, and you have to bring in unusual prizes.
Oh, yeah, I watch
prizes.
It quite religiously, actually.
Yeah, well, I won the, spoiler alert, I won the series I was in, so I'm going to do Champion of Champions if I'm well enough, and that would be a good prize, wouldn't it, to the first round prize if you brought in your own testicle. I'd give my right bollock to win Taskmaster. I wanted to do like a joke, like just as I was going under anaesthetic, but it didn't seem appropriate. I was going to say something, I'd give my right bollock not to have to go through this or something like that, but it just never quite felt.
Yeah, yeah.
Never felt
just as well you didn't use it.
It'll be in the inevitable show and book and the podcast, One Pod Podcast. I've got the problem is the doctor told me all this stuff and my mind's already racing, going, oh great, I can do this, I can do that. You know, as a comedian, you're just always looking out for what comes next. Do you remember being in the Gay Daleks, Jeremy? Do you remember your appearance in Gay Daleks?
I don't remember that, but I'm willing to concede it happened.
I think it was just a voice. You wouldn't be allowed to do that now these days, Jeremy. It's 2003.
No,
you can't do Gay Daleks now.
At least I don't expect people to believe that a male model's bum in a jockstrap is mine.
Well, it was mine. I can show you again. I'm wearing a jockstrap now. I can show you the real.
Maybe a jock. Yes, it'll be horrible. I don't think we want to see that. Thank you very much.
You probably don't want to see it. Well, it's lovely to have you on.
We have met three times.
Jolly
nice of you to ask me.
No, well, it's lovely to have you. We've met three times before. We were trying to work it out before. I was on Newsnight, I think, discussing offence in comedy. That's usually what happens. I was on an election special where you talked to us very briefly. It was Steve Punt, Rebecca Front, and me, and I did question why I'd been booked as part of that triumvirate, whether they just thought we can't find someone with the name that rhymes, but we'll get the next best thing. But my first meeting with you, you won't remember, was in 1995 in a lift in BBC TV Centre. And I, before we were on TV, just going in for one of our first meetings, and I stood next to you and I touched your briefcase with my hand and you didn't even see me. So there you go. So this is our fourth
meeting. I'm beginning to think this is not an advised appearance.
Well, I was going to say about you that you don't suffer fools gladly, so the next hour is going to be quite interesting.
Get on with it, you dolt.
You can't be rude to me. I'm the interviewer. You've got to be. We'll get into some stuff. It'll be fine. I've been listening to your audio book this week. I've got through the whole thing, 12 hours. You reading your own audio book, which is of your autobiography, that one.
Oh, yes.
Which is from a few years ago. But I very much enjoyed it. I'm very glad you read it yourself.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. What I liked about it is you've got a very understated humour. I quite like the jokes. You throw the jokes away, and I like that. There's a joke where you are driving to Tipperary, and you say it was a long way, but it's a throwaway joke. It's very good. It's interesting to hear you being honest in a way that I suppose you couldn't be when you were working for the BBC and when you were on the news programmes. So the chapters about Northern Ireland, for example, where you actually sort of give your opinion about who's in the right and who's in the wrong in Ireland, which is quite unusual to hear that, but it's quite refreshing to hear someone just give their honest opinion, which we don't really... We don't get the BBC, but you increasingly don't get it anywhere, really. Do you think? No, it's very rare someone goes... You talk about how most uprisings, the people doing the fighting are doing so because that's their last resort, because they've been driven to it, and you're sort of sympathetic to the non-UK side, I guess, more than you would have been on the BBC. Was that refreshing for you to be able
to keep digging this hole? I'm enjoying it.
I'm not digging a hole. I'm digging a hole for you, if anyone. Did you enjoy that with the book, that you were allowed to sort of finally sort of state opinions rather than...
I suppose so, yes. But I mean, I if we were having a conversation, that's the reason I want to do this podcast thing, is because, you know, if you have a conversation, you've got to be yourself. You can't be anything else.
Sure.
And that's the same with the book. If you're writing it in the first person, you've got to be frank.
Yeah.
And I can't see any point in hiding your light under a bushel.
But you wouldn't have been, if you were still like employed at the BBC, you presumably you wouldn't have felt you could have written that book. You had to wait till you'd sort of moved on, do you think? Or would you still...
I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. And also early on, I think the stuff about you being at boarding school is very interesting, which is a life that I did not have, and I think most people don't have, but that most people who are rulers have had. And you didn't have a great time at school.
No, I didn't like it.
No. But do you think that's doing it, it sort of felt to me, it's sort of not for you. I think it worked out quite well for you as a personality and what job you chose. But given that most of our, the government sort of went through that similar experience of fags and, you know, weird rules and being away from their parents when they're kids, do you think that sort of explains? I just sort of wonder if those people are equipped to rule us when they, and to lead us when they haven't really, when they've sort of had this experience in childhood where love has been sort of not taken away from them, but certainly it's an odd experience, isn't it?
I don't really buy that argument. I don't think it's true that all our rulers are from that sort of background. If you think about the people who we've had, we've had Blair, Gordon Brown, Cameron, of course, was one of those.
Yeah.
But more recently, Boris is. But, you know, Rishi Sunak, I suppose, Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Well, nearly, they're all from Eton now, aren't they? That's the...
Well, Rishi Sunak was at Winchester, wasn't he?
Well, you know, it's all the same to the to us plebs. It's all the it's all. The
same
deal.
Research, you lazy bastard.
I'm saying, generally speaking, they were all public school educated people. But a lot of them are from Eton.
Oh, you're now.
I didn't have to research Rishi Sunak when I was got Jeremy Paxman. I've listened to your whole book. Who else? You wouldn't have done that. You didn't do that when I came on Newsnight.
What, you want the whole book reciting to you?
No, I've had it all recited to me. I love the fact that you do, I love having the author reading the book. Right, I think that's really great. You're a good performer. We're just getting your ear at the moment, Jeremy.
Oh, are you? Right, good. Yeah. Well,
I'll just lie back like a drunk in the pub. Is there anyone from the past before audiobooks who you would like to hear reading their own audiobook? That's one of my emergency questions. So let's bring one out quickly.
You must be desperate. You must be, if you're bringing out emergency questions already.
I know. Well, we're talking about audiobooks is really all we're doing.
I would have liked to answer the question. Jeremy. I'd like to have heard Ian Paisley's audiobook, wouldn't you?
You'd like to hear that?
Let me tell you, friend.
I'm not sure it would keep you awake. A lot of these books.
Let me smell your breath.
You're not allowed to make me laugh. Actually, it's all right. I'm coping with the pain. So, from your book, here's some things I've gleaned that I'm interested in talking about. You shoot squirrels while sitting on your toilet. I want that you pass over that quite quickly, and I would like to. I can't understand how that's possible.
And well, you've got to turn around, of course.
You turn around, so there's an open window behind you.
I'm not buying crap, of course, but just sitting on the loo, and if it's by the window, you sit on the loo with the lid down,
right?
And you know, with an air rifle, you can pop off a squirrel or two.
Okay, that seems a cruel thing to do to the squirrels.
Why is it cruel?
Well, it kills them, presumably, or maims them.
Doesn't do them much good.
Are they annoying you, the squirrels, for you to do that?
They are annoying me, yes. Yeah. They're always getting on the bird feeder. I mean, I love songbirds, and I can't stand the fact that squirrels are always driving them off, and that they kill all sorts of things. They kill trees, for example. Entire trees are killed by squirrels. They're a menace. Okay.
So you see yourself as sort of the judge and executioner of for their squirrel crimes.
I think so, yes.
They poo on my car. That's what they do to me. So I'm happy for you to take them out, I have to say. If you want to come round to mine and shoot them out of the attic, you can do.
That's very good. Okay, fine. Have you got a loo I can sit on?
I forgot a car. I'm not sure there's one with a good view of where the squirrels are. But we'll find something for you. I live in the countryside now. We'll find something for you to shoot. It'll be fine. Let me ask you a question about the book now. Well, there's loads of... Again, the John Gielgud story I thought was very interesting. So as a reporter, you interviewed John Gielgud. There's a lot of things you sort of slightly skirt over, and I would like to know more about. John Gielgud, you interviewed him at a theatre. Do you remember this story?
And
you,
I do, yes. It was at the Old Vic.
Yeah. And he arrived and he was in his 90s or whatever.
It was towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
And he is still, he's dead, isn't he?
I think he's dead.
He's dead. Yeah. And he arrived, and he was. I helped him up onto the stage, and we got onto the stage, and he said, what's happened here?
Hello, you've gone off. There's a J. It's all right. We can carry it. As long as the audio works, it does. Really.
Oh, I see. Very good. Well, I've got a message from Vodafone that I have to give them some money. God, it's annoying.
I can still hear you, so let's carry on.
Okay, all right, fine. We'll carry on. No, I helped him up onto the stage, and when we got onto the stage, he said, I wonder if there's a lavatory nearby. And I then suddenly thought, Christ, I've just helped him up onto the stage. There's going to be no loo. And then I thought there must be one in one of the dressing rooms. So we went into the dressing room, and he said, I wonder if you could assist me. And I got the very strong impression I wasn't the first man to have held his cock.
Well, I'm sure you would. So do you think it was, did you feel it was a subterfuge on behalf of Sir John Gielgud to...
No, it wasn't. It was, he was just, I think he just wanted to pee.
Yeah. But then did the driver on the way home, he said that he had to stop six times for him.
So it makes sorry, it, he said, yeah, what do you give that John Gielgud to drink? He said, I had to keep stopping on the M40 for him. And I said, well, he just had a glass of water. But poor chap, you know, when you get old, you need to pee quite a lot.
Yeah, but you don't usually ask someone to hold it for you. I mean, I think it's there. You're back. Look, you're back.
I am back. Yes, I pressed OK.
There we go. It was as simple as that.
Yeah.
Is it, if you put 50p in the meter, the internet meter, to keep it going? And well, there's a. I generally think it's a really good autobiography because we get opinions. We get well, you know, because also for a lot of people. They're mainly aware of you from Newsnight. So there's this whole career before Newsnight of travelling the world and getting shot at and going to trouble spots, but then also working on local TV and stuff. So what was the closest, you say? I mean, like a lot of it's a very dangerous occupation, the sort of war reporting and going to trouble spots.
It's very dangerous, but I don't tell war stories because I just think it just switches the focus from whatever's happening wherever you are to me, me, me. And that's the besetting problem with television. It's full of vainglorious fools who want to be on telly instead of just letting the story tell itself.
Sure. You do tell the stories in the book, though, so, you know, I would recommend it. There's some interesting stuff. So, I mean, there was...
That's good. Recommended by a man with an impenetrable podcast.
But, so, you know, I'd forgotten that you were involved in the early breakfast television, and you'd obviously worked in local TV in Brighton and in London as well, which I wasn't living in London that time, so I wouldn't have seen London Plus. Which sounds like I didn't necessarily miss a great deal.
It was known as Sod Off Kent.
Because that's a time when, you know, you are critical of people for wanting to just be on TV for the sake of being on TV. But some of those early jobs are not, some of them were very journalistically sound, obviously, and then something like working on the breakfast TV is a bit more of a celebrity job, isn't it, than a news job, maybe?
Well, it was less that in those days, but right. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So as a young man, you sort of did understand that part of it. And you know, you obviously have to take work and you obviously have to go where the work is.
But, yeah. And you've got to learn the job, haven't you, Richard?
You do. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. You've got to keep going, and if you do it long enough, eventually you'll get better at it.
We'll see. This is the 319th episode, so...
There's been 319 of these.
Something like that, yeah. And then there's more than that, really. I've done it a lot. It's, you know, there's... To look, it's like Les Dawson to playing the piano. To look this incompetent, it takes a lot of skill. We'll get there. We'll get there. That's how I'll make mistakes you know, I'll lull you into false sense of security. It'll be fine. But you are, in the book, you're quite rude about news. You don't think newsreaders you don't have much time for newsreaders.
I think newsreading is an occupation for an articulated suit, that's all. I can't see any point in reading the news at all. Reading aloud. Do you remember reading aloud at school? That's what it is. I don't think it has any grandeur or skill or anything to it.
Yeah,
any fool can do it.
I mean, but that's true of a lot of jobs on TV, isn't it? A lot of jobs on TV are just sort of...
Probably true of a lot of jobs full stop.
Yeah, that's probably true. So it's, but it is, I mean, I'm fascinated by that, the way that sort of fame, you know, you become famous for certain things. I mean, I sort of think, you know, actors are sort of now the new nobility almost. And you sort of think, when you think what an actor does as a job, it's fine, but it's not the most important job in the world. And yet they're treated as like,
you know, completely unimportant.
World. Yeah.
Reading somebody else's lines. I mean, it's, you know, what an evanescently pointless thing to do.
It's, you know, it's entertaining, but what I don't understand is why those people then become, you know, get into the position where they can, I mean, some of them do become royalty,
yeah.
And then can treat people badly, possibly. But, and I was very, I like honestly about the BBC, because you clearly sort of love the BBC as well as having a Jeremy Paxman style, copyright style disdain for a lot of it. But
I think you have to decide, would the world be a better place if the BBC didn't exist? And I come down on the side of saying, no, the world would not be a better place if the BBC didn't exist. But it is an immensely frustrating organisation. It's full of, you know, boring people doing dull jobs and pretending they're important. Whereas... Yeah. Its true mission is just to make interesting programmes.
Sure. But it's sort of, I mean, because it's been going for such a long time, and I think, again, you were there, so you've been there since the 80s, maybe a little bit earlier.
I've been there since 1922, or whenever it was.
Whenever it was. But it's sort of, you're sort of astride the old days and the new days. So I think you look back on the old days and with, you know, thinking things were better in a lot of ways, but also that, for example, the story you tell about what happens in the event of a royal death and all the kind of incredible stuff that you were supposed to go through, though I don't think anyone ever did go through it, is sort of unbelievable.
That's right. It was absolutely absurd because the organisation was caught in this trap between recognizing a news story and acting as mourner-in-chief. And they got into a real muddle about it. So, you know, there were all these instructions issued about how you had to have a black tie and a grey suit and a white shirt. And these were all kept in a cupboard upstairs. And when the news came in that a member of the royal family had died, you were to continue acting perfectly normally, discussing the common agricultural policy or some rubbish, and then to race quickly out of the studio, run down the corridor, press the button for the seventh floor, get in the lift, get out of the seventh floor, run down the corridor, get into the wardrobe, take out your jacket and tie and shirt, put them on, run back to the studio, and then say it is with deep regret the BBC announces the death of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. And, of course, we were all rehearsing for the death of the Queen Mother when, you know, Diana was killed.
Sure.
And then that was all caught on the hop, and Peter Sisson's got a terrible amount of flack for announcing it while wearing a burgundy tie.
Right.
Which was ridiculous.
Why wasn't the wardrobe next door to the studio? Why did they put the wardrobe so far away?
Well, because these decisions are not made by people who actually make programs.
But you can't. The idea of having to, you know, to change to deliver a piece of news is really important, and the BBC wanting to be the first to get in there, but then deliberately sort of scuppering them. So that would have taken surely 10 or 15 minutes for that to if you'd done. Did anyone ever do it?
Did probably take about 10 minutes. Well, I lost my white shirt, unfortunately, because Robin Cook came in for a discussion about the European Union, and we had quite a distinguished cast. There were about a dozen people there, including the Prime Minister of Latvia, the Foreign Minister of Slovakia, and various others. I have no idea who these people are, and nor did we have any idea of what their national flags were. So the Prime Minister of Slovakia, or Foreign Minister of Slovakia, or whatever he was, sat down and said, "Why am I sitting under the flag of Slovenia?" And he said, "Sorry, it's purely symbolic." And Robin Cook came in and sat down. He was the Labour Foreign Affairs, but maybe he was Foreign Secretary at the time, I can't remember. He sat down, and the bloke who was putting the microphone on him knocked the cup of styrofoam cup of coffee he had all over his shirt. Robin Cook went absolutely bonkers and said, "I can't go on air wearing this coffee-stained shirt." And so I said, "Well, you can have mine." So I gave him mine, I think I gave him the Diana suit, or the Queen Mother suit. And I never got it back from him. Terrible thing.
I don't know how big Robin Cook was, but you're a bigger man than Robin Cook, aren't you? You must have been.
I am, but that's good. If it had been too small for him, that would have been a problem, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. It's just like him being swamped, sitting like a. I sort of. It's because of the spitting image puppet, I guess. I imagine him being like a little tiny gnome sitting in your giant's, in your Gandalf costume.
Yeah. It's like you in your pants.
Yeah. Well, I could be sitting in my pants. Well, you could all be sitting in our pants. That's the beauty of.
I am sitting in my pants.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. And then I didn't know this. There's a lot of stories I didn't know about you. As we're talking about pants, let's talk about pants. I did remember this when I got to it, but I'd forgotten about it. That you became a sort of a crusader for men's underwear and affected the shares of M&S by criticising M&S underwear as falling apart too easily.
Yeah, this was very unfair. I mean, I've got a solution to this. That all underwear should be sold with a sell-by or best-before date on it. Do you know how old your pants are that you're wearing now?
I don't. Well, it's interesting because the same thing happened to me, but then I wonder if it's partly to do with my... I get Paul Smith pants, which is a terrible... an expensive way to get your pants, and they all started going through in the exact same spot, and like for about 2 weeks I just had to throw away pants after pants. That they all started splitting at the same bit. But now I'm wondering if it was to do with my heavy ball that I've just had taken out was rubbing against them, and that might explain it. But there are certainly pants there that I've definitely got pants in my drawer that are older than my marriage, which is 9 years.
Yeah, that's very bad.
Yeah.
And if you ask anyone how old are the pants you're wearing today, they can never tell you. And the thing is that, like everything, they wear out.
Yes.
And if they wear out...
Having brought M&S to its knees, that's what you realised it wasn't really their fault.
I don't think it was their fault, really.
No.
I mean, any kind, if you wear Calvin Klein, Paul Smith, anything, they all go in the end.
Yeah, it's true. But, you made a big fuss about it.
I didn't make a big fuss about it. I sent a private note to Stuart Rose saying, "I've always been a fan of Marks and Sparks." And some twat published this.
Right. Well, what pants do you wear? Do you wear M&S now, or have you moved on from M&S?
Sometimes I wear M&S ones. I might be wearing M&S ones today, in fact. Right. I've certainly forgiven them. Okay. It was very, very unfair, that the way they were held up to public ridicule.
But then they took you out for lunch and sort of got their revenge by making you
touch a
man's pants.
It was very funny. It was Stuart Rose invited me to lunch, and There was a knock on the door, and through it came this man, this Dutch male model, who said, or rather Stuart Rose said to him, "Hello, Remco. Now, those pants you're wearing, are they self-supporting, and they were self-supporting. And then the key thing is, apparently in men's pants, it's do they have access? Access means do they have a hole in the front for you to pee, for you to have a pee?
Yeah.
And some of these thongy sorts of things he wore did not have access. But it was very embarrassing because he kept saying things like, he was having a really good time. Stuart Rose, who was the boss of M&S at the time, he said, do feel free to feel them. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never felt another man's pants while he's wearing them.
Well, John Gielgud, you have?
No, not exactly, no.
I don't think I have, no. But, you know, it sounds like he was a good-looking young gentleman, so I'd have had a little feel.
Would you?
Yeah, definitely.
It crosses a boundary. I mean, if it were Bettany Hughes, as I heard on your podcast, in her suspenders, I'd think differently about it.
Let's not get onto that.
Why on earth not?
I used to not understand the no access pants. Same were on pants, Jeremy. But now I do. I thought, because you have to pull them down like a child does. But I have all my pants you have to pull them down to go to the toilet. Might be why my testicles have gone awry.
You have to pull your pants down to go to the loo.
You have to pull. Well, if there's no hole, you have to just pull down the front to go to. Like, you remember when you were at school and you were 5 years old? Yeah. Do you remember how you could wee all the way up the wall, Jeremy? Can you remember how high you could wee when you were 5 years old?
Oh, happy days, eh?
Did you ever try and wee? We used to try and wee over the wall in the primary school because there was like a wall you could get it over the top. Can't do that anymore. But yeah, you just pull down your pants. It's going well, isn't it? It's going well. I was very interested in the story about the mysterious package you received that turned out to be a stolen Enigma machine that someone had stolen.
Did I ever get to the bottom of it? No, I think.
Did you ever get to the bottom of why they sent it to you?
Well, I think they just were reasonably confident that if it did come to me, although there was some buffoon in the management at the BBC who said, of course, there's a news blackout on this, we can't publicise it at all. I think they thought if they sent it to me, I would at least say that I had received this thing and that the thief could then prove that it existed because it had a key thing missing from it, a key element, one of the rotors was missing. And so I think that's what it was. I'm not sure.
Because I'd have kept it. You're quite honourable in throughout.
Well, it wasn't mine to keep. Someone has stolen it.
Yeah, but no one would know you had it. It had been lying in the office for 2 weeks already. You hadn't even opened the package, so it hadn't
worked. That is true.
And so you could have got to, the Dalai Lama gave you a toffee. You were trying to turn that down because you were too principled to take a toffee.
Yeah, and I turned down a case of whiskey once from the Arab League.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty tempting, I can tell you. But I mean, when they sent me Shergar, for example, didn't I begin to smell after a bit?
You could have your own little museum of all these people. It's an odd thing to receive. It's
the receiver of stolen
machine.
Goods, yes.
Yeah. But, okay, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to go to some emergency questions. People are very excited about the emergency questions I'm going to ask you. And so I'm going to have to do a few and we'll see how they go. And then we'll go back to your podcast. And time's flying by. Would you rather, Jeremy Paxman, it's an important question. Would you rather have a hand made out of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream?
A hand made out of ham or...
It's a simple question, Mr. Paxman. Would you rather have a hand made out of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream? Answer the question.
I'd rather have an armpit that dispenses sun cream.
Okay, good. Thank you for answering the question.
Where do you get these bloody stupid things from?
Well, as you say in your book, it's sometimes good to disarm people with a question they haven't been asked before and then find out where it goes, but I thought it'd be funny.
I've honestly never been asked that.
Yeah, that's, and then we get some new stories. Have you ever seen a ghost, Jeremy Paxman?
I don't believe in ghosts, but I think I felt one once when I was staying in a house in Ireland.
Yeah.
And I felt this very cold presence. When I walked down the stairs in the middle of the night, I felt this very cold presence brush past me. Right. And I thought that must have been a ghost.
Or, you know, some wind.
Or a bit of wind, yeah.
Yeah.
That can cause you a lot of trouble.
Or just a cold bit in the house. Could be that.
Could be.
What do you think happens? You were asking, I was listening to your podcast where you were talking to Michael Palin and being a bit rude to him, but he took it well.
I wasn't.
And you asked him. You were saying, when are you going to start? You're too old to go around the world, you were saying to him. You were being very cheeky to him. It was with love, but you were saying, you weren't not going to be going around the world when you're 96. He might do. He's a good man.
He's a good man.
You
I
asked
like him
about what... Yeah, he is a good man.
What's your point?
We can agree on that. Well, you were asking him about what he thought happened when he died. What do you think? What do you think happens when you die, Jeremy? Have you got any thoughts about what's coming next?
I don't know. I wish it would be very interesting to know if there was something coming next. But I think when I die, my body will rot. I think that's all. That I mean, I'm with Bertrand Russell on that.
Yeah. I agree. I think like having. It's interesting going under anaesthetic and the way you just sort of turn off and then you get turned back on again, don't you, with the anaesthetic. But basically, you're sort of gone and you're just gone. And I assume that's what death's got to be like.
I suppose so, yeah. Although you don't wake up with a bit less of your body.
Well, you wake up with... You don't wake up at all and all of your body's gone. If you wake up and they're burning you. Yeah. I was glad to have the anaesthetic. They offered me... like a spinal local anaesthetic for it, and I couldn't think of anything worse than
watching
having
your
to
balls
endure
be cut
being
off.
Away.
No.
Pardon?
Watching your balls be cut off. No, I
yeah,
don't
I mean, I would, I look away if they're putting needles in my arm. You know, I can take it, but I don't like to look at it. So the idea of even just being, I can't imagine that you would the psychological damage of sort of even being awake, even if you're looking away. You know what's going on. It was just so wonderful to be able to. You know, they didn't even count backwards. I was just out, and then I was awake again, and then it was, and everything was over. So, I was very impressed with it. Very, very good. The NHS are very good, aren't they, Jeremy?
They are great. I like the NHS. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think good. It's great, and I'm rather proud of it.
Yeah. Well, they've done. You know, that's you were saying you'd had an accident, and they saw you very quickly recently before we got into the podcast, and you know, just. With everything that's going on at the moment, for them to be, you know, they're so nearly everyone, I'd say 95% of people just so cheerful and professionally cheerful.
They're wonderful.
Yeah, so it was very good.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But, right. Well, let's talk about the podcast. So it's been going for a little while and it was sort of obviously conceived pre-lockdown, but you've managed to keep it going through lockdown because the idea is... that you go to a pub and chat with someone you want to chat to rather than someone that has been put in front of you.
Yeah, I just was sick of having to interview people about politics. night after night after night. And, you know, those things, there are an immediate tussle to establish the terms of engagement. And so you start, and you've got to get them on the back foot pretty early on. Sometimes you can do that by attacking them from the left when they're expecting an attack from the right. Sometimes humour can help. All sorts of possibilities. But I just thought it was rather pointless in the end. It was a dialogue of the deaf. And so I just thought it would be nice to talk to people who you really wanted to meet, who had things to say, and to do it over a pint, too, would be jolly nice, too. And then, so we got about three of these conversations over a pint under our belt, and then we had to carry on doing it remotely over this ridiculous thing that you've got here.
Well, given you're doing it remotely, you don't seem to have mastered the technology at all, which is good to see. So congratulations on that. But I found it, what I love about my podcast is it's in front of an audience usually and it's live and you're with the person. But I have found doing them online interesting in a different way. Have you found it still works as a...
I don't find it at all interesting. I find it really frustrating. What is your point?
I think there's different things about it. I like your podcast because the intro is just loads of you saying, "Oh, this has gone wrong. What's going on? I can't remember what's happening here. It's turned off." So that's good fun. But I know, I think there's a sort of intimacy to an online conversation as well. I've found them, you know, this has been like my little social life is on a Wednesday. I'll talk to somebody for an hour and then I'll go back to looking after my kids.
You are a really sad man, Richard Herring.
I am.
So this is your social life.
Yeah, but I'm not that bothered about going out anymore. I've got two young kids and it's, you know, I'd rather just sleep if I can get the chance. But there's a sort of different energy. If you're doing something in front of an audience, which is what I usually do, then obviously people play up to the audience a little bit, which can be good. But I think doing it online, you can sort of forget that it's real sometimes. You can forget that it's going out sometimes. And so I think you can get into quite interesting areas.
Certainly you can forget this is going out.
It's going out live.
Are both your listeners tuned in?
We've got actually 347 people watching at the moment, which is pretty high for
347?
Yeah.
That's very good. Yeah, how do you know so precisely? How do you know so precisely?
Because there's a little counter there. It's actually not like that. It's 377. The people at home have got a better counter than me. So it's nearly 400 people. That's very good for live. And then tens of thousands of people hundreds of thousands of people will listen to the podcast. And tens of thousands of people might watch the podcast on YouTube. They'll have a great time with this one.
They will. They will.
This is one made for video. You know, this has happened. I've been doing podcasting for like 12, 13 years or something like that.
Have you? I've only just started. I'm a novice. Give me some tips. I know. Tips.
All you TV people coming in and getting in my patch.
All right. Give me some tips then, mister.
Yeah, I was going to get you to give me some tips. Well, you don't need any tips. It is exactly that. It's the conversation. It's trying to find an interesting way into talking about something that people haven't talked about, I think, isn't it?
I don't know about you, but it seems to me that the great pre-requirement for our job is to be curious. Sure. And if you're not interested, if you don't naturally ask, why is it like that? That reminds me of such and such. If you don't naturally think that, then you're in the wrong job.
Yeah.
I find people endlessly fascinating, and I love talking to them.
Well, it's nice as well. And this is what I like about the podcast. As I think you've discussed, you know, you're in control of it. You're deciding who the guests are, and booking the guests can be a pain in the ass. And I appreciate the good work bookers can do, but also you're getting people that you actually want rather than someone saying, "Oh, you know, that you're interested in." And pretty much everybody I've ever had on is someone that I want to talk to them because I'm interested in this or that. But yeah, so you know that element of it, the element where obviously you're not getting paid £1 million a year to present this podcast, presumably, Jeremy, is
no, I'm not getting paid anything.
No.
Just do it out of interest, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I did to begin with. I'm starting to get paid for it now after 14 years, but it's, but also I just think it's a good way of getting stuff out. I'd rather the things existed. For me, it was the same frustration. I think being a comedian and being a journalist have a lot of similarities. And you know, I was frustrated with having to jump through hoops to get stuff onto TV and radio, and just the ease of being able to go, okay, well, I've got an idea. And I think, you know, you get to a point, don't you, when you think, I know more about what makes good TV or radio than someone who's 30 years younger than me, who's just started a job, who's deciding what goes in. So, you know, I think it's nice to be able to prove that and be able to come and do it.
God, you're sounding like a real old fart.
Well, I'm 53. I find it hard to believe, Jeremy, but are you now 70?
I am 70, yes.
70 years old.
Very, very old. Very old.
I might not get off any moment. You could, but you could also go on you could be doing a wee with someone holding your penis in a theatre in 23 years. So,
well, that's an aspiration devoutly to be wished for.
There's something to look forward to. But, I think it's. I like getting old. I want to get old. This recent emergency has made me think about not getting old, and then suddenly you go, oh, you know, I was quite looking forward to getting old, so I hope that happens. I'm confident it will.
You know what I think is great about getting older?
Go on, what?
You don't have to give a monkeys. You don't have to care what people think about you. You don't have to worry about being, you know, polite. You just have to be yourself.
Did you ever worry about that, Jeremy? Were you ever worried about being polite?
I think I was, actually. I still say please and thank you, of course. But I think it's just great not to have to care about what people think.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the disease of the young person is that, I mean, and for me, I was so self-conscious and so worried about doing the right thing that it absolutely stultifies you, and, you know, you don't do anything because you're too scared of what people will think. And so it is wonderful to leave that behind and know, yeah, I'm just going to crack on and see what happens.
Even as a comedian.
Yeah. I mean, I think on stage was where the only place I could sort of slightly do it. But even so, you were still you're worried about, you know, not getting any more work, doing it wrong, not being good. So it's very hard to enjoy it in the early days in the way I do now. But in socially speaking, I was very awkward and socially insecure right through my 20s and 30s, really. It was really only was about 35 I sort of started sort of getting over all of that and thinking, why am I wasting my time? You know, when the thing is, like, you worry about that worry about what people will think. And the truth is they're probably not going to think anything. No one really cares that much. So it doesn't, unless you're doing something absolutely terrible, it's going to get forgotten anyway. So it's,
tell me, do you call this comedy?
This show? Yeah. I do. I think this is spontaneous chat, and I think it usually is pretty funny. Yeah, so you're being very funny, Jeremy, and it's sort of.
I think we'll let the audience judge that.
We'll let them decide. But whilst I can talk about you. You're being funny, and I think it's sort of not quite a pastiche of an interview show, but it's I'm breaking the rules of an interview show, so I'm doing it in a comedic way. Also, I love this show because it'll usually at about the 45-minute point where we are now, then we'll suddenly talk about something serious anyway, because it just, even if you've got a comedian who's being funny and funny and funny, you'll get into some interesting discussion about something, because that's the way conversations work. So I think that long form, it gives you the freedom to be funny, and I'm starting off trying to be funny, but I think it also gives you the freedom to open people up, and that's what this is why my one works, and I'm sure your one works in the same way, and for what I've listened to it does is that you get people talking, and then if you're having a nice time, they'll sort of start saying stuff that
they relax, yeah.
and it's that relaxation that's the fun of it. And I think if you've got comedy in there, that's good. And I think, you know, but your style is still quite comedic. You're it's the character of Jeremy Paxman, which might be the real Jeremy Paxman, but this, you know, this disdainful sort of slightly superior character who will question everything. You're a little bit snide, but likable, but it's a funny character. And so you're a comedian as well, I think.
But comedy's hard, you know.
You've done the Edinburgh Fringe. I know you've done the Edinburgh Fringe.
I did do the Edinburgh Fringe, and I found it really terrifying. Mm. I found it completely awful. I didn't enjoy it.
Well, the Edinburgh Fringe is the least enjoyable place to do comedy in lots of ways. I've been a lot, and I do like it a lot, but it's a hard place to have a good time because of all the various pressures going on. But I think it's the same thing. It's the same as anything in that you've just got to. You've got to sort of believe enough that you just get on with it. And you know, I didn't see that show. I don't think I was in Edinburgh the year you did your show.
You didn't miss unusual. Much.
What? Wait, you had a wheel, I understand. You had a spinning wheel with
I had a big
on it.
A big wheel with subjects on it. And then
yeah,
I think the audience could spin the wheel. And I can't recall what happened. I blotted it out. It was too horrible.
Did people come and see it? Is that did you get good audiences, or was it?
The place was full every night, but it was. I didn't enjoy it. I just felt too nervous, and I'm not naturally a comedian. I'm not naturally a performer.
I see. I think you are, but I think it's understanding what your clown is. I think in terms of, and I guess you know, as a comedian, you're a sort of straight comedian, but. You're the sword of the straight man, but it's the wink beneath it. You're winking at it, aren't you? When you're doing an interview, you'd sort of, what's interesting, I think, and again, from your book, what's interesting is as a journalist, you sort of know, you've got a good idea of what's going on behind the scenes and what the politician usually is not telling you. You know why they're not telling you it, and you know what the truth is, and you know they're not going to tell you. And so that's a sort of little comedy dance of you trying to wheedle something out of Michael Howard or whoever.
That is one way of looking at it. But I just found it completely terrifying.
Yeah, it is. But, it's an unusual thing to want to. But so is any sort of form of being in public and talking in public. But, yeah, it is.
Don't you find, what happens to your sphincter when you walk on stage?
It's fine now. When I was young, when I did student reviews, I'd have to go to the toilet about four times, like before each show. But now it's I can walk on. If you just said, even now we haven't been on stage for 2 years, if you just said you're on stage now, go on, I would just be able to do it. But it's you've got to really want to do it, and you've got to go through some horrible experiences in order to get there. So any comedian. And some of them claim not to, but I think they're just deluding themselves. You'll have had so many bad gigs early on.
I can't see it's worth it. What's the satisfaction is hearing people laugh, isn't it?
Oh, it's great. It's fantastic to making people laugh. It's a powerful feeling, and that's why a lot of comedians turn crazy and get too arrogant, I think. Because when you've got you're in control of a room full of people, and when you get it really right, you've got them in pain with laughter, and you know you've got something funnier coming up. And so that sort of power, I feel, my wife says this about me, is, you know, and I think I like on stage, I'm like a different person, and I feel like I'm properly alive on stage, which I am off stage as well, but I'm not at all like it off stage. And so if I don't perform for a bit, I become a bit of a nightmare, though I've been a bit better in the last year or two. But also, there's something turns on that just really, really enjoys that experience for some reason. Not always. Sometimes it's when it's bad, it's horrible. Yeah, when it goes wrong, it's an awful thing. But I love the risk of it, and that's increasing. That's why I like this doing podcasts, because I'll make sure I've done the research. But you don't often. None of the research ends up being in the show, but then you're creating something out of nothing. But also it can go, you know, the stuff I've been doing online over the lockdown, a lot of it's kind of quite high concept and weird and is a risk. But then almost without an audience, but as we are now, we don't know what the audience are thinking about this. And that's quite liberating as well, because you just go, okay,
poor buggers.
Well, you just crack on with it. I'm doing a ventriloquist show, and the first time I did it, which was an improvised ventriloquist show, and I've never learned how to do ventriloquism. And the first time I did it, there was a couple of moments you think, oh God, this is just weird. But like people like it and I like it and it's getting better all the time and you're finding, you're discovering stuff. And I think that that's the best way of writing is to do it on stage and that and discovering a comic, discovering something funny on stage that you didn't know was coming is the best, I think. It's just, that's a God, incredible
yeah.
feeling. But that's the same as surely, you know, you're prepped for an interview with a politician or whoever, and then something will occur to you or, you know, something falls into your lap or someone doesn't answer in the way you expect them to do, and then you've got to improvise around that. So you're doing all the same job. We're doing the same job and the same thing.
We it's are, just, and I find one of the most frustrating things is listening or watching an interview when the interviewer just goes on to recite the next question on their notepad.
Sure.
And very often they've already been answered. That question's already been answered. And I just found myself screaming at the radio or the television, for Christ's sake, he's already answered that.
But it's listening. You've got to listen and be thinking about it's a complicated thing, right? So
it's not that complicated.
Well, you've got to listen and know where you're going.
It's just a conversation.
So it's complicated to the extent of that. And so you've got, the main thing is to listen, right? So that's exactly. But I've seen that with, when you interview students, they'll come in with a pad and then they'll just go, they'll be shaking and they'll just go, right. And then they'll read the question and
they're
clearly not listening and then just read the next question. So it's a weird thing to happen to for a professional for that to happen.
Yeah. Poor thing.
Anyway.
Yeah, go on. Give me an emergency question.
I'll give you an emergency question just to prove how that works. I'm going to ask you a new one. This is a new one. What is the most unusual free/mistaken item you've been sent in an online delivery? I got some Despicable Me stickers with some jock straps. Have you ever had anything delivered incorrectly?
I've never had any jock straps delivered to me or Despicable Me stickers. I'm afraid.
Have you ever had anything else wrong, though, that you ordered something and something else turned up? Well, there was a little gift. I mean, you've had an Enigma machine. I suppose that's quite an unusual.
I suppose that, yeah, that's quite an unusual one. I can't think. I was just thinking, actually, about the ridiculous emails you get. There was one I just received about a man who chopped his penis off because he was told he had too many lustful thoughts and he thought he was going to enact the biblical injunction to cut off whatever offends you.
Right.
And, you know, I get lots of that sort of rubbish all the time, but I can't... Terrible, this shortage of next of kin in West Africa, isn't it? I mean, it's just awful. All these people with no known relatives. I think we should set up a farm and send people out there to act as their next of kin.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's worth signing up for you. There's a lot of money in it, apparently. Do you get quite a lot of saucy messages as well, or certainly in the book you mentioned a couple of... You sort of skirt over a little bit, but there's that sort of sex symbol version of you that... My wife didn't see it. I said, he's a very sexy man. My wife said she didn't see it, and I said, well, you're wrong. He's very sexy.
I have no idea what you're
My wife's not
about.
Interested, is what I'm saying.
That's a stay away, matey.
Did you find that happening a lot with the guests a little bit? You talk about a baroness who tells you she's not wearing any knickers and gives you hotel details. But
yes.
were you sort of hit on a lot in the news?
Not very often, unfortunately. I mean, you know. Do you want to be hit on by John Selwyn Gummer or someone?
At the moment, you know, I've got to take it where I can get it.
That's just because you've got one ball. It'll be all right. Don't worry.
Okay. No, only John Selwyn Gummer will have me now. I haven't got a complete set of genitalia. That's why he's fine about that. What about you? Went for lunch with Lady Di, and it turned out to be just you and Lady Di. Was that romantic overture from Lady Di?
I don't think it was. I think she was just a bit lonely.
Right.
I think she just used to invite people for lunch because she didn't see people. It's rather like us in lockdown, you know?
Yeah. And you said it was, you didn't really have much in common with her. So you literally got invited to lunch. It was just you and her and you had to sit there eating
yeah, yeah.
quails or something.
Well, I can't remember what it was we ate. I suppose I should remember that. But I do remember there were a couple of very gay butlers who lifted up, went in for synchronized lid lifting on these two plates that we had. But I don't remember what we ate. What was beneath the lid?
You don't seem to be particularly excited by celebrity, but you
certainly not. It seems to me the evanescence of nothing. I mean, who was it? Was it Frost who said a celebrity is someone who's famous for being famous?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but you've met a lot of people who are, you know, are very accomplished. And
I've met a lot of people. Yes.
Yeah.
I have.
And you get to mix in those circles and you get in, you sort of get to, it feels like you want to maintain this outsider image, which is correct, I think, but you still get to go inside and step inside the Citadel and see all these people and dine with them. And
That's true. I've been very, very fortunate in that respect.
Yeah.
Very fortunate. And I don't suppose that it would automatically happen if I hadn't had the sort of career I've had. But
yeah,
you know, it's pointless to take it seriously.
And you seem to have a lot, you seem in the book, you seem kinder to Boris Johnson than to Tony Blair, for example. You seem to, although you have some good things to say about Tony Blair, you do say at one point that he's, you compare him to, who do you compare him to? You mentioned some people who've been disgraced. It might be Jeffrey Archer and Tony Blair discredited. You called Tony Blair discredited, which is quite harsh.
I think he is a bit discredited, isn't he? I mean, that war in Iraq was a disgrace.
Yeah.
We were led up the garden path on that. It was really shocking. And if you're inclined to believe people who say that they should be believed, then it's perfectly reasonable, I think, to say, I'm very sorry, you've let me down.
Sure. It was an interesting decision because he seemed so, everything he did, he seemed so concerned about what the public would think about him until that point. And then he didn't seem to care about that one thing. And that made me think that either he knew something we didn't know, or he had all that power and he had all that momentum behind him, and he could have sort of done anything. And he was a bit cautious, I think, in the beginning. And then the Iraq War was not cautious and not popular.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. And I suppose one should admire him for that, for flying in the face of public opinion. But I don't.
No.
I'm afraid to say that I think that it was he should have listened to people.
But Boris Johnson, you may have given his first TV job as well, so, as well as being, you think he's quite a good company, at least.
Oh, he's amusing company. He's amusing company, but I did give him his first TV job. He was, I think, the Daily Telegraph's person in Brussels. And I just said to the then editor of Newsnight, let's get this bloke in Brussels on. And first, it was about corruption in politics. And one of the people who was on with him was, I think it was Gaia Savadio, the Italian journalist. And I said, Gaia, do you know Boris? And she said, oh, yes, he used to be my son-in-law. It was very funny.
So it's your fault then, basically. You gave Boris Johnson a TV career and promoted his anti-Europe and European ideas. So everything that's happened comes down to...
That's a fault. See, I don't think having anti-European Union ideas, which is not the same as anti-European, of course, I don't think that's a fault.
I didn't say it was a fault, although I'm not sure I agree with you, but... I know. Well, I know
you. Fault.
You did. Well, in the book, you talk about doing a program about sovereignty, and being told that would cost the Remain campaign 500,000 votes, which was all it took. That if their 500,000 votes had gone the other way, then we'd be...
People aren't that stupid. I think people can work it out for themselves.
Do you think so? I'm not sure. You've got to act on that basis.
You've got to act on the basis... Yeah, you don't think there are people sitting here watching you, Richard Herring, make cheap points about Brexit, and they say, oh, well, I'm going to vote differently next time.
I don't think that. But I think Jeremy Paxman, they might do. Why? I also think it was too... I think it's too complicated an issue for people who really think about stuff. I think it shouldn't have been... We should never have been asked about it. Whatever, well, regardless of the truth
stupid,
of what's right or
wrong.
We're too
stupid, are we? It came down to a very simple issue. And if you're saying we're too stupid as the people of this country to make a decision, then I say nuts to you, matey.
I think it's too complicated an issue to go yes or no on. That's all. I just think there was too much going on. I think your analysis in the book of why it happened and why it went that way is spot on. I think in that I think the campaign was the Remain campaign wasn't good enough, and it was and, you know, they didn't focus on the right things, and it was too difficult to sort of, you know, like you say, I think people were goaded into being made to feel stupid, and so they said fuck you.
I don't think they were goaded into making such a sort of apocalyptic decision.
Well, a little bit. I mean, I think it was. I think that feeling of being treated with disdain by a metropolitan elite. I think there was a feeling of that.
Yes, and you know, when we get down to it. Aren't you and I part of that metropolitan elite?
I wish I was, but I think you are, yeah.
I think you are. You sit there in your red T-shirt in your fake resuscitation room.
If this was a real resuscitation room, then I think I'd be in the elite. Yeah, I mean, we are, you know, yes, absolutely. You know, both you and I, especially you, have very charmed and lovely lives. And it's interesting stuff, but I'm going to blame you for
Boris Johnson. Well, I'm going to blame you, Mr. Oxford man.
I worked my way. I didn't go to boarding school. Went to the Kings of Wessex School in Cheddar. Worked my way up. And I was told that the BBC guys won't employ people who went to Oxford now. So it's actually... I can't get any of my stuff on the BBC because they won't let anyone who went to Oxford, which is fair enough.
Maybe that it's not very good. Have you thought about that?
It might be, but that's not what I was told. I think it's fair enough. Bring in some different people. I've done enough. I've done enough rubbish.
I think you have.
I'm going to let you go in a second. It's been very lovely. Very lovely to talk to you. We haven't even talked about University Challenge.
No, we haven't.
You're the longest serving quiz host of any programme in the world or in the UK?
I've no idea.
I read that somewhere which you've been doing that for a good long time though, right?
It's 25 years, long time.
Is it?
Yeah.
My goodness. Because I remember, well, it's interesting that you weren't going to do it because they didn't ask, that you thought they hadn't asked Bamber Gascoigne, and then you bumped into Bamber Gascoigne, you said he didn't want to do it. So that's why you ended up doing it.
That's right, yes.
Chance meeting with Bamber in the British Library.
That's right. You've got a good memory, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They approached me and said, would you like to do it? And I said, well, you should really ask Bamber. It's his show. And then there was a lot of crap about how the zeitgeist had changed. And I said, well, I still think you should give it to him. And I bumped into him in the reading room in the British Library or British Museum, as then was, and said, look, you know, Granada are thinking of bringing back University Challenge. You should get in there. And he said, oh, yes, they asked me about that months ago. What absolute crap about Zeitgeist. He asked me about that about months ago. But I don't want to do it. It's too much like hard work.
Well, there you go. So, and are you finding it hard work or are you still enjoying
it? I enjoy it. I like students. You know, I, you must remember what it was like to be a student.
I do. Well, I feel like I still am, but time's passed by quickly.
It does pass very, very fast.
It does.
And that's a real old person's observation, of course, that time passes quickly. But I like students. I like the fact that they're enthusiastic. I'm amazed by what they know. I'm amazed by what they don't know sometimes. But I know.
Well, it's still very hard. I mean, I think you say in the book it's harder than people say it's easier than it used to be. But you're claiming it's harder than it used to be.
It's much harder than it used to be.
But they're very hard. I've been asked. I couldn't do it in the end. I was asked to come on the one you have where you have people come back and do some celebrity
ones,
version.
The ones whose vanity is greater than their common sense.
I think it's too hard. I wasn't like falling over myself. I've done Mastermind and I've done different things, but I think University Challenge is so hard.
But the questions are easier on that celeb special.
Yeah. They'd have to be because no one would answer any questions. They're very.
That's right.
It's very specialised knowledge. Well, it's great. So is that going to carry on forever? Are you going to be?
I don't know. It's going to carry on forever, but it's going to carry on for a little while yet.
And the podcast. And is there anything else on the horizon for you? Is there more books?
Oh, I love writing books. Yes, although I love that. I've actually lost 4 chapters of my latest book today. I don't know where they are. They're somewhere in cyberspace, I think.
Oh no, that's a disaster when that happens, and it still happens. However much you back up, it still does have 4 chapters. That's quite impressive amount of stuff to lose.
It is, and they're not even consequential chapters or sequential. They are consequential, but they're not sequential. But there we are. That happens.
Do you think you're going to find what's the book about? Are you allowed to say, or is it?
I don't have any. I don't have any secrets. It's about coal. It's about the history of coal mining in Britain. And then the one after that I'm going to do is about the Civil War.
Cool. Yeah. And what has attracted you to coal?
No one's done it. It's an amazing story. Well, you think all these guys going down holes in the ground, risking their lives in order to bring something as common or garden as coal to the surface in order to keep us warm. Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And it fueled, it fueled the Industrial Revolution. It fueled all sorts of mechanical innovations, and it made it possible for people to read and write.
How did it make it possible for people to read and write?
Because they could sit down in the warm and read a book.
Okay, yeah, I see.
And they and light, gas light came from coal.
Sure, of course, yeah. Well, I look forward to that if you manage to not lose the rest. If you're going to read, are you going to do the audio book as well of that yourself?
Yeah, you are a lazy bastard, aren't you?
I like the audio books. I like them. I've been lying in bed listening to you talk about yourself for the last week.
You saddo. You poor man.
It's been terrible. I'm just checking. There was so much to talk to you about. You were in Bridget Jones' film. Look at that. That was pretty good. You've done little bits and pieces of acting as well, mainly as Jeremy Paxman.
Yep.
But that's all good. And Do you remember when I touched your briefcase with one of my hands in the lift? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I remember the hands. It was your right hand, wasn't it?
It was. Who was the most impressive person when you first went to the BBC and got in a lift? Who was the person that was... The reason I say that is because we did in Fist of Fun, which was the first TV show I did. That was a joke I did about how impressed I was to see you in the lift. So that's why I'm doing that for the fans.
As a joke, I see.
Well, not as a joke, it was true, but I was also impressed. So, but it was me going, this is brilliant for Stu. I saw Jeremy Paxman in the lift. Who was your Jeremy Paxman when you first went to the BBC? Who did you see at the BBC and think, oh my goodness, I'm at the BBC and there is Jimmy Savile?
I once went to the loo with Peter Snow. That was actually at ITN.
Right.
And he was standing next to me in the urinals and I thought, God, this is fantastic.
There you go. That's your... It's always with you. It always comes back to being in the toilet and pants, toilets.
Yeah, it's all... I'm genitalia obsessed.
You are. It all comes back. It's pathetic. That's what boarding school does to her. To a man, I guess. I suppose that's...
Have you got anything else to say?
Look, Jeremy, it's been absolutely lovely to have you on the podcast. I'm glad we managed to make it work most of the time. And yes. Technically,
I hope it goes better for you next time.
No, I'm sure it was. I don't think it could go better. This is in the top 10. It's going to be fine.
All 177 viewers will join your view of that, I suppose.
Well, we'll see. And then, you know, we'll know. We'll let you know. And do listen to Jeremy's podcast if you want to hear, like, short interviews with people in a pub. They're, like, 30 minutes long. It's a pretty good length for a podcast. Not an hour and 15 minutes like this one is.
Yeah, this is far too long.
And the audiobook and the autobiography book are well worth your time as well. Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff in there. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back next week with Brian Regan, I believe. But this week, give it up for the amazing Jeremy Paxman. Thank you very much. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahala Stepper with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Jeremy Pakalakadakdak Paxman. The music's by Pest. Thank you very much. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, of course, as always, not that one. Also to everyone at Acast, to Ben Walker, and everyone at the British Comedy Guide. You know who you are, everyone at YouTube. Thanks, guys. You're doing a great job out there letting us upload videos and stuff. Wow. What else have I got to say? This is a Sky Potato Fuzzle GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to GoFasterStripe.com/badges to become a monthly badger, or if you're with Amazon Prime, go to my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/RKHerring, and you can subscribe at no cost yourself and give me £3.50 every month if you can be bothered to go back every month and resubscribe. It's a bit easier to do once you've done it the first time. Please give us free money. If you don't want to give it to us, please give someone that free money. If you're with Amazon Prime, it costs you nothing. And why not buy my book, The Problem with Men? Or my book, Emergency Questions, 1001 Conversation Starters for Every Occasion. All right, bye. My fan friends, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.